This is day two of this July 2012 7-day session. And we'll resume reading from our text of yesterday, Swampland Flowers, the letters and lectures of Zen Master Dahui. He starts off this letter with a quote that he doesn't attribute to anyone. So it's in quotation marks. Buddha taught all doctrines to save all minds. I have no mind at all, so what's the use of any doctrines? End of quote. And then Dawi comments, basically there's nothing in any doctrine and no mind in mind. Let's go back over this, where this unknown speaker said, I have no mind at all, so what's the use of any doctrines? This word mind can be used in different ways in Zen. I think what this speaker means is there's nothing in the mind to which he's attached. There may be thoughts going in and out of the mind, but there's nothing he's getting snagged by. And we call this a state of no-mindedness. When you're in a state of no-mindedness, that means a state of no thought. That's, you don't need doctrine. You're there. And then Dawi chimes in. Basically, there is nothing in any doctrine. So this is just the basic experience of the Dharma, that what we call doctrine, the words and concepts in a doctrine, are fundamentally without any substance to them. Basically, there is nothing in any doctrine and no mind in mind. Mind itself, what we call mind, is without substance. It's a certain process. Really, strictly speaking, when we refer to mind, this the functioning of our brain. We always really mean mind-body. This mind-body-body-mind complex that is ultimately ephemeral. It has no fixed nature to it. That's the no-mind of mind. And he continues, the emptiness of mind and things both is their real character. Well, their fundamental nature is without substance, both mind and things. This sentence brought to mind a couple of lines from our Affirming Faith in Mind, where we say, things are things because of mind, as mind is mind because of things. These two are merely relative, and both at source are emptiness. These two are merely relative. That means there's no mind apart from things. There are no things apart from mind. It's just two ways, two angles, from which to see this. From one side we can call it mind, from the other side things. But there's no bright line where mind ends and things begin, or vice versa. Because we have different words for these two, we have the word mind and we have the word things, this deceives us into thinking of them as separate entities. But how can they be separate? How can there be anything apart from the mind that apprehends it? Where, what world is there where you can have trees and cars and buildings and birds without the one apprehending those things, the subject? Where is there a world of just objects with no subject, or just subject with no objects? It's just an abstraction to think that these are two different things in some fundamental way. They rely on each other. They dependently co-arise. You can't have one without the other. Hence, these two are merely relative, and both at source are emptiness. This may be rather abstract to people who haven't really experienced the emptiness of form, but still, the fact that it seems so odd, so intellectual, doesn't mean that it's not the way things are. Being able to grasp it is a whole different thing. That can only be done through direct experience. We can figure it all out in our minds. We can sort of get the gist of all this. One can appreciate the logic, the reason of this, that things are things because of mind, and mind is mind because of things, and so forth. But the hard part is grasping it as a living reality with one's body. The emptiness of mind and things both is their real character. But these days, students of the way often fear falling into emptiness. So this is what, when we mentally divide these two, the world of emptiness and the world of form, then emptiness, we misunderstand into emptiness. It seems like something off the edge of the world that we can somehow fall into. Those holding such views misapprehend expedient means and take the disease for the medicine. They are to be pitied deeply. So, a common misunderstanding that what we have to fear is emptiness, but in fact it is the cure. The seeing into emptiness is the cure. Therefore, he quotes a great legendary Buddhist layperson, Layman Pong, Chinese. Therefore, Layman Pong said, "Don't be averse to falling into emptiness. Falling into emptiness isn't bad." And yet, it may be the primal human fear, falling into emptiness. Or, to put it another way, disappearing. This is really what the fear of death is. It's a fear of not being. It's arguably the most profound fear of our species, not being. But it's groundless. people who are reaching a very deep state of mental quietude, emptiness, will sometimes have this fear coming up, this fear of disappearing, not being. Losing is really just the fear of losing the self. But losing what we think of as the self has never hurt anyone. Losing the concept of a self, it's a wonderful thing. We've dragged this notion of a self around our whole lives. Wouldn't it be nice to lay it down? But there is this deep anxiety about losing oneself. And that's the resistance that we encounter when we are really moving on, getting into deeper places in our practice. And then Dawi quotes the layman again. He also said, "Just vow to empty all that exists. Don't make real that which doesn't exist." If you can see through this one saying, then the ignorance born of boundless evil deeds will instantly melt away and disperse. Even the whole great canon taught by the Tathagata cannot explain this one sentence. Well, be that as it may, I'm going to try to say something about that sentence, knowing that I can't, if the Tathagata can't, that I can't either. Just vow to empty all that exists. Vow to see the other side of things, the other side of this world of phenomena, which is no things. Really, we don't have to make that vow formally. All we have to do is lose ourselves completely in our practice, whatever it is. This is what reveals the emptiness of things. That nothing exists, nothing has any permanent fixed existence. And then the second half, don't make real that which doesn't exist. We could say that this is really the fundamental task before us, is not to imagine that this world of phenomena somehow exists in a permanent way. World of phenomena, particularly thoughts. Don't imagine that thoughts have any kind of reality to them other than just an ephemeral, transitory kind of reality. We could say that our job is then not to reify concepts. Reify means not to make real what's not real, not to believe in or give credence to concepts and thoughts. This is really the very basis of meditation, Zen meditation at least. Is not to be deceived by our thoughts, not to buy into them. That's it. Not to, if we don't believe in them, we're not going to get caught by them. If we don't get caught by them, then we're willing to just let them pass through the mind, and they will continually pass through the mind. We just get out of the way, let them do their thing, and just keep returning to the practice, but 99 out of 100 times people will get snagged by their thoughts because they don't see them as really empty. And then I'm skipping a kind of a dense paragraph here, and then he continues. Buddhist disciple Chen, remember he's addressing someone in a letter, one of his students, you have realized that personal existence is false and that things are illusory. So he seems to be saying you've had some insight into your true nature and the true nature of all things. Amidst illusory falsehood, you were able to contemplate the saying, Mu. Suddenly, while washing your face, you found your nose and sent me a letter expressing your understanding, trying your hand at explaining Chan. So apparently this guy had a first Kensho of some kind. And as we'll hear, it was clearly not a thoroughgoing realization. You sent me a letter expressing your understanding, trying your hand at explaining Zen. This was like a three-day-old tiger cub who already has the spirit to devour an ox. The message conveyed by you, though, was like a lucky monkey hitting the ground with a stick. Where it hit, it went in a few inches, but where it missed, it had no grasp of the issue at all. You can see a monkey just sort of flailing around with a stick wildly. Sometimes it hits the ground, sometimes it just goes off in this direction and that direction. So he's really throwing some cold water on... It would be interesting to see the letter that Dawi received from this guy. Where it hit, it went in a few inches, but where it missed, it had no grasp of the issue at all. Though in the main, your basis is already correct, you are not yet clear about the great Dharma. This is a common disease of beginners entering the path. If you can realize such a thing, push it to one side and take the essential gate of all the Buddhas and patriarchs and shut it at once. Only if you find a life on the other side of the primordial Buddha will you gain mastery of the Dharma. So he's saying what a good teacher will say to any student with the first experiences. Okay, now forget it. Go beyond that. You've got much farther to go. You've had a taste, but now you have to go much, much further. Don't settle for that little experience, he's saying. And he says, but right now, without being clear about the great Dharma, if you say such things, then I'm afraid you fall into what Jung Chia called realizing emptiness, denying cause and effect, wild and reckless, incurring calamity. Again, this is someone who's had a glimpse into the emptiness side of things, enough that they dismiss causation and think that somehow they're beyond it. Dawi says, you shouldn't be unaware of this. Just get the root. Don't worry about the branches. Over a long, long time, it will sink in thoroughly. Don't worry that you won't attain oneness. Work on it. The world of Zen is littered with people who have had some fleeting experience of emptiness, and imagine that that is genuine awakening. It can be so so harmful to one's practice. There's nothing in itself about had that. It can be actually wonderful just in itself, but too often one will make too much of it and get attached to it. Here's another letter. Good, it may be, actually it may be a continuation of the same letter because there's no recipient mentioned here. So the editor maybe just split these up. Good and evil arise from one's own mind. But tell me, besides your activities, thoughts, and discrimination, what do you call your own mind? Where does your mind come from? If you can discern where your own mind comes from, then boundless karmic obstructions will be cleared away instantly, and all sorts of marvels will come of themselves without being sought. Where does your mind come from? Good question. He presses this point. Where do we come from at birth? Where do we go at death? If you know where we come from and where we go, then you can be called a student of Buddha. Who is it who knows of birth and death? And who is it who experiences birth and death? Again, who is it who doesn't know where we come from and where we go? Who is it who suddenly realizes where he comes from and where he goes to? And who is it who, contemplating these words, blinks his eyes, unable to understand, his belly churning up and down as if a mass of fire were placed in his heart? If you want to know, just apprehend him at the point where he can't understand. If you can recognize him then, you'll know that birth and death surely have nothing to do with him. So he's urging the reader, us, let's say, he's urging us to pursue the question to the bottom. And to really do that, we have to orient to this very moment. That's why he says, who is it who blinks his eyes and unable to understand, his belly churning up and down right now, who feels confusion? Who is that one? If you want to know, just apprehend him at the point where he can't understand. Right there. Look right there. The real work of investigating a koan is not trying to come up with an answer. There are koans where one can get away with that, sort of doing a sort and coming up with a plausible answer. But certainly for a breakthrough koan, that's not going to work. It's losing oneself in the question itself, settling into the question, not trying to figure it out, come up with answers, but just sink deeply into the question, become the question. That's the way to have it open up, reveal itself to you. And he continues along this line. Whenever you're reading the sutras or the stories of the ancient worthies entering the way, coming to awakening, when your mind doesn't understand clearly and it seems bewildering and stifling and flavorless, as if you're gnawing on an iron spike, this is just the time to apply effort. Above all, you must not give up. This is the place where conceptual knowledge doesn't operate, where thought doesn't reach, where discrimination is cut off and the path of reason is annihilated, where you can always explain reasons and apply discrimination. This all pertains to emotional consciousness. Time and again, people take this thief as their son. Be aware of this. To really, really grapple with a koan is not a pleasant experience. It's just as he says, it's stifling, flavorless, as if you're gnawing on an iron spike. But that's just the direction to go, because we have to leave our comfort zone in order to discover what is beyond it. In a way, it has to be uncomfortable. If it's comfortable, then we're not extending ourselves. We're not going beyond the known and familiar. It is basically uncomfortable for us as human beings. It's uncomfortable for us to venture beyond the known and familiar. We're venturing into the dark. This is what provokes anxiety in so many people right before sesshin, is whether they are aware of it or not, they are approaching the darkness, just meaning the realm of not knowing. It doesn't mean evil, it just means not knowing. Everyone who comes to sesshin knows that they're going to be moving away from the known. And that's where the money is. It's so hard to do because of the discomfort of it, because we cling to the known. And literally, we cling to our knowledge, we cling to our ideas, our thoughts, our concepts, in order to avoid the dark, the not knowing. So it is that sesshin does take courage. There's no question about it. Courage to proceed into the darkness. I'd like to read a wonderful analog for this whole process. I see from my notes that I just read this in sesshin about a year and a half ago, but I'm going to read it again. And this is a story about a naturalist by the name of Louis Agassiz, considered really unorthodox in the time. This is from the 1850s. He taught at Harvard in the 1850s. And apparently when he'd take a new grad student or an assistant, he would hand this newcomer a pickled, evil-smelling, dead fish, which was personally selected by the master from wide-mouthed jars which lined his shelves. The fish was placed before the student in a tin pan. He was to look at it. The student was told to look at the fish, and then Agassiz would leave. And he wouldn't return until later in the day, if even then. So one of these students wrote about this. This guy's name is Samuel Scudder, who went on to become an entomologist. And this is what he reported. In 10 minutes, I had seen all that could be seen in that fish. Half an hour passed. An hour. Another hour. The fish began to look loathsome. I turned it over and around, looked it in the face. Ghastly. From behind, beneath, above, sideways, at three-quarter view, just as ghastly. I was in despair. I couldn't use a magnifying glass. Instruments of all kinds were prohibited. My two hands, my two eyes, and that fish. It seems a most limited field. I tried pushing my finger down its throat to feel how sharp the teeth were. I began to count the scales in the different rows until I was convinced that that was nonsense. At last a happy thought struck me. I would draw the fish. And now with surprise I began to discover new features in the creature. So okay, this is when we start to get a little insight into the koan. Some sense of getting a purchase on it. When Agassiz returned and listened to Scudder recount what he had observed, his only comment was that the young man must look again. And then now we're back to Scudder's account. I was mortified. Still more of that wretched fish. But now I set myself to the task with a will and discovered one new thing after another. The afternoon passed quickly, and toward its close, the professor inquired, "Do you see it yet?" "No," I replied. "I am certain I don't, but I see how little I saw before." This is pure Sesshin experience. I see how little I saw before. The day following, having thought of that fish most of the night, Scudder had a breakthrough. "The fish," he announced to Agassiz, "has symmetrical sides with paired organs." Of course," Agassiz said, obviously pleased. Scudder asked, "What do I do next?" Agassiz replied, "Oh, look at your fish." The lesson lasted 3 days and nights. "Look, look, look." Scudder later termed this experience a legacy the professor has left to me, as he has left to many others, of inestimable value, which we could not buy, with which we cannot part. Look, look. Here's the German philosopher Wittgenstein said, "Don't think, look." This is some of the best advice anyone can get in Sesshin. Don't think, look. The two are vastly different. One is looking directly. It's direct experience. One's eyes open. Attention, look. The other is thinking, blah, just sifting through thoughts in the mind. That's not looking. Here's another letter. This one is to Li Shurpao. Maybe it's Li Shurpao. "You've indicated you want me to instruct you by letter in the direct essentials. This very thought of seeking instruction in the direct essentials has already stuck your head into a bowl of glue. Though I shouldn't add another layer of frost to the snow, nevertheless, where there's a question, it shouldn't go unanswered." Here, this is just what a teacher is is facing all the time is knowing that the student ultimately has all the wisdom she or he needs within himself or herself, knowing that there's nothing you can give the student that she doesn't already have, and yet feeling obliged to say something or at least respond somehow. This is part of the basic tension of being a teacher. Well, there's one famous teacher from China, ancient China, who whenever he was asked about the Dharma, he would just turn his back, face the wall, just turn his back to the student. But for all the rest of us, it's this dilemma. And Dao Yi here is the same. He says, the very thought of seeking instruction has already stuck your head into a bowl of glue. The fact that you should imagine that you need instruction from anyone about what is a matter of direct experience, your own direct experience, you're already sort of handicapping yourself. And then there's the here comes, though I shouldn't add another layer of frost to the snow, still, where there's a question, it shouldn't go unanswered. Okay, got that out of the way. Then, I ask you to abandon at once all the joy you've ever felt in reading the words of the sutras yourself, or when being aroused and instructed by others. Be totally without knowledge and understanding, as before, like a 3-year-old child. Though the innate consciousness is there, it doesn't operate. So let's just go back over this. Abandon once all the joy you've ever felt in reading the words of the sutras yourself, or when being aroused and instructed by others. There's nothing that would make me happier than if people after Taisho would just forget everything I said. Just leave it. Leave it. Leave it. To help people leave it, I've always instructed the monitors to use the stick fairly soon in the round after Taisho. I know from experience, having that work for me, of the tendency after Taisho of just settling into one seat and maybe kind of, you know, turning around in one's mind a little bit, you know, like, you know, winding a strand of hair around your finger, just sort of thinking about something and reminds you of this, and it's, they run up this association, and isn't that beautiful, that those words of that master, and it's not what any teacher wants, is you to sit and generate more thoughts out of his or her words. Be totally without knowledge and understanding. Let it go. Whatever you think you've understood, let it go. If you're thinking about what was said, then you're not present. Without knowledge and understanding, like a 3-year-old child. Though the innate consciousness is there, it doesn't operate. It's silent. The mind is silent. Silently absorbed in one's practice. Then, look at what's there before the thought of seeking the direct essentials arises. Look and look. As you feel you're losing your grip more and more and your heart is more and more uneasy, don't give up and slack off. This is the place to cut off the heads of the 1,000 sages. This reference to your heart is more and more uneasy. This is what we're just talking about this basic discomfort of leaving this world, the comfort zone of thoughts. Students of the path often retreat at this point. If your faith is thoroughgoing, just keep sitting. What precedes the thought of seeking instruction in the direct essentials? So what is your question about the direct essentials that you might pose to a teacher or to anyone? Where does that question come from? What's the source of that? That's what he's directing us to. He's really directing us to this realm of that precedes any stirring of consciousness, this realm of not knowing. That's the well. That's the well we have to keep going back to. And we find our way back to it through complete absorption in the mu, in the koan, in the breath. All of these are just different delivery systems to get us out of our thoughts and into this realm of direct seeing. Suddenly you awaken from your dream and there won't be any mistake about it. Well, this is a good place to stop. We'll stop and recite the four vows.